feel about cooking.
Well, what have you got left to do?
Do the crackling. I've got to make my beurre blanc. I've got a lot to do.
Come on, go, push.
We fetishize cooking in our society today. We all watch television shows about these heroic athletic chefs who can do these amazing feats while the clock is ticking down behind them.
This week, a man from California has been traveling around the UK talking about that very simple thing we all do, or at least watch.
With knives flashing and fountains of flame, and it looks terrifying. It looks like work best left to professionals. And indeed, if you ask people, so do you cook or can you cook? They'll often say no, even though they can cook perfectly well. They just can't cook like that.
After writing about agriculture and then nutrition, one of the world's biggest selling writers on food has turned his attention to the bit in the middle, cooking. Cooked is not a recipe book. Instead, it asks, why do we cook? Why did some of us stop? And what are we missing when we do? If we don't reclaim that skill now, he says, the market economy is more than happy to provide solutions.
If they could reach down your throats and digest your food for you, and they could do that profitably, they would.
Over the last few days, Michael Pollan has been talking about cooking to packed audiences at the RSA, the Royal Society of the Arts, in London, to crowds in Bristol, and this weekend at the Hay on Wye Festival. A trigger to some reflections of our own on our relationship with the kitchen and with a homely skill that seems so simple, but one that in the last couple of generations has become so, so complicated.
They're in the pot. You need some chives and some thyme from out there, please.
Yes, please.
Yes, please. Don't eat the chives, buddy, because you're not going to have enough left.
It's a Thursday evening in a house in North London. A mother, Donna, is cooking with her two children, Bertie, 5, and Reuben, 9. Magic is about to happen. Raw ingredients will soon become mini meatloaves.
80 grams of quick-cooked oats.
Yep.
Love that part. 2 large eggs beaten.
For a lot of us, what's going on in that kitchen is ordinary, something we take for granted. For others, a much larger number, it's a bit exotic and probably unnecessary. But however you see it, Donna's efforts to involve her children in the kitchen, to learn and pass on some skill, tell us a lot about what's been happening in British homes over the last 40 years. And their experience goes to the heart of the themes in Michael Pollan's book.
The thing that sticks in my mind is my mum had never baked me a cake, ever. She was a single parent, 2 children, she had to work all the time. We were Findus crispy pancakes and, you know, Arctic rolls. So she never cooked for me. Joe, my husband, can cook, although his mum didn't really cook for him either. And I didn't want to hand over boys that couldn't cook, basically, to somebody else. And I just think it's an amazing experience for them to create something. I mean, it's chemistry. They learn. They can see different reactions and put it together. And suddenly you've got an amazing meal or an amazing cake.
Home cooking is in free fall. It's been declining since the mid-60s. In America today, we spend 27 minutes on cooking per average and 4 minutes cleaning up. Now, I know. Now, that 4 minutes should tell you something. I mean, what kind of cleaning up can you do in 4 minutes? You can crumple a pizza box and scrape some plates.
I mean, this book is about food, but it has a deeper subtext, which is really about, you know, how we live our lives. And cooking or not cooking is one example of many ways in which we've outsourced production. And I'm arguing in a way that we need to readjust the balance between consumption and production in our lives and do a little bit more production, partly because it feels so good when you do it. And I need to stress that pleasure is a very important part of this process. This is kind of my love letter to cooking, because I fell in love with cooking in the process of writing this book. I was one of those people who was very impatient in the kitchen. I wouldn't let the onions sweat long enough to really get sweet. You know, after 10 minutes, I'd throw in the tomatoes, whatever it was. And to learn how to be in the kitchen and not fight it, and the reason we fight it, of course, it's not obligatory. There is that alternative. You know, it's as far away as the telephone. And then you feel the pleasure of feeling self-reliant. Wow, I can do this. Cooking engages all the senses. So it's actually a wonderful way, as the mom says in there, to teach kids about other things, measurement, math. You know, you have chemistry, but you also have physics, and you have microbiology. It's all there, plus all this, the big species that you can notice, the plants and animals that are involved. So I do think that to let your children leave home, go off to university or whatever, without having acquired a life skill quite as important and as essential to their long-term health and happiness as cooking. It's just a shame. You know, we put so much time into teaching them how to drive. We teach them at school now about safe sex and drugs and alcohol. These are all very important life skills, central to health and well-being. Cooking should be right up there.
You ask a question in the book. You say, is home cooking today a reactionary or a progressive way to spend our time?
And we have been taught by the food industry and many, many other voices in our society that it is reactionary, that it is going backward, and that progressivism and modernism argues for ready meals and restaurant food and outsourcing everything to corporations. And I'm suggesting that the more progressive thing at this point is to keep the corporations out of this essential part of our lives, because they're not serving us very well. They're not doing the work well. They don't cook well. They use way too much salt, fat, and sugar. And they cook kinds of foods that are special occasion foods, you know, things like French fries and cream-filled cakes and all these things that you wouldn't make that often at home because they're a huge pain. But if corporations are doing it, you can have French fries twice a day. Given where we are now, economically, which is in a hyper-specialized economy where, you know, we're supposed to do one thing at work. You know, you do radio, I write, and we take our money from that and we use it to pay for others to service us. I think the more progressive thing is to bring some production back into our lives, whether it means growing a little bit of food, cooking your food, basically redefining leisure to include production, and hold this space outside of the marketplace.
Now, we are under enormous time pressure. There's no question. We work too hard. In America, we made a tremendous mistake, I think, with our labor movement. We fought for money. We didn't fight for time. In parts of Europe, the fight was very much for time. And in many countries, especially in the Scandinavian countries, but also in Germany, they really fought for time. And they have...
To the extent you can provide a little bit for your own needs is to feel that, yeah, I can imagine living in a different way. And that opens you to political change of all different kinds. But what you see in that clip is, as the women we heard from first from North London, how easy it is to engage children in cooking. That, you know, children are obsessed by transformation. They love transformation, one thing into another. And that's what cooking is about.
And what I found in the case of cooking was that almost all kinds of cooking, regardless of culture, fell into one of four transformations. There was the one with fire, the most basic, putting an animal over a fire.
The book's heart is about that transformation, the alchemy of cooking, divided into four themes. Fire, barbecuing.
There was
water,
which is cooking in pots over a fire. And it's really the basis of world gastronomy. Agriculture depends on that pot with water because you can soften grain, you can make porridges.
Air is about baking.
The baking of bread, which is an incredibly important innovation that happens about 6,000 years ago and really allows us to subsist on wheat and other grasses.
And earth about fermentation.
This is kind of the most miraculous transformation of all. This is cooking without the use of any heat whatsoever, but simply using microbes, bacteria, and fungi to process our food.
Cheese, pickles, beer.
Kimchi and sauerkraut, pickles, yogurt, and alcohol. A very important fermentation.
Pollan travels the world, meeting the masters of each art, understanding the culture as well as the science of cooking. He involves us in the marvels of fermenting vegetables and muses on the chemistry of an onion. But as I asked him, in order to cook, do we really need to understand the science?
We don't need to. It's just really fascinating. I find if I understand the science, when I'm chopping an onion and this amazing plant is fighting back and has these defenses against my knife and my eyes, if I understand that at the chemical level, I'm going to learn how to outwit that also. It's going to equip me to deal with it. And that when I have a scientific explanation as to what's going on, I remember what to do. I have a story. I don't just have a fact. Like, you should salt meat a day or two before you're going to cook it. I might or might not remember that little tip. It's a very important tip that professional chefs will teach you. But now I understand that when you salt meat, the first thing that happens is liquid is drawn out of all the cells. So you're drying it out, actually, which tells you if you're going to salt too close to cooking, you're going to have a very dry piece of meat. But if you do it 24 hours or even 48 hours in advance, something very interesting happens, and that the liquid that's been drawn out of the meat mingles with the salt and whatever other spices you put on the surface. And then there's a vacuum created in those cells, and so the liquid is drawn back in now with lots of flavor. And you will get much better meat if you do this. Now that I can visualize that little exchange, which is invisible to us, but now that I know the story, I'm going to remember to do it. So that, to me, is the value of science.
The book may be a love letter to cooking, but it's also one that reaches down to its deepest roots. The work of Richard Wrangham, a professor of anthropology at Harvard, looms large, particularly the ideas from his book Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human, which explained how, 2 million years ago, cooking got baked into our DNA.
It gives us so much energy compared to eating raw food that we are actually an animal that no longer is capable of living off raw food in the same way that every other animal is. We have very small guts, very small teeth, very small mouths compared to a great ape of our body size. That means that we're biologically adapted to eating cooked food. And we can ask when those biological adaptations are first recognized in the fossil record. And the answer is almost 2 million years ago.
This is essential to our identity as a species, not to mention as communities, as families. I mean, cooking goes very deep. And Wrangham is, I think the importance of his work is demonstrating that our evolutionary path has been shaped by that amazing discovery of what cooking does to food. And that when we learned this, and it was before we were Homo sapiens, I mean, he's talking about when we were Homo erectus, or on the eve of becoming Homo erectus, that is what allowed us to acquire these big, complex brains. So it's written into our DNA now, cooking. We are the cooking animal. And there are no other animals who cook, although there is one exception that proves the rule, and that is some animals, if you include fermentation as one of the transformations of cooking, which I do, there are animals who bury their food. And it turns out they're not hiding their food. Squirrels, for example. They are actually beginning this process of microbial breakdown that makes the seeds much more digestible. So in fact, squirrels are the exception that proves the rule that we are the cooking animal.
Wrangham also argues that cooking for millennia, and specifically women cooking, is at the basis of our social structures, marriage, and the division of labor along gender lines.
Once you cook, no longer can you eat the food immediately you get it. Cooking enforces a delay while the food is being cooked. And while the food is being cooked, it's vulnerable to being stolen by hungry men who've gone off and didn't do anything by way of getting food. So it creates an ownership problem. And our sexual division of labor, in which a woman cooks for a man, solves that problem. She says, I'll cook for you. He says, I'll stop anyone else taking your food. She's obliged to feed her husband.
He's lost in the wilderness!
Which is why the 1960s and 70s for pollen are the crucial decades in the decline of cooking. We asked Rose Prince to give a British insight into that decline. In her book Kitchenella, she sets out her ideas of what she calls the lost kitchen.
I think that a lot of people were very tired of spending all day baking and producing the evening meal for their husband. It's when they would like to go out and have the same careers as men. That would mean giving up certain household duties, and cooking was one of the first things. They also left a door open for the food industry to replace that nurturing role. And then what was also lost was the verbal tradition, the hand-me-down knowledge that a mother would pass down to her child, and then one day her child would pass down to its child. Those secrets of practical and economical and often very creative cookery have been very hard to replace. I mean, there's no book really, no television show, not even internet cookery, that can replace that living tutor in the home.
Cooking was women's sole responsibility for a very long time in many, many different cultures. And maybe Wrangham's theory explains it. I mean, it's a just-so story. We can't say for sure. And in fact, the decline in home cooking does parallel women entering the workforce. But it could have worked out differently. This is not an inevitable problem. What happened in the 60s and 70s with the feminist revolution and women entering the workforce was that it became necessary to renegotiate that division of labor in the household. It simply wasn't fair to expect women to work, also do all the housework, cooking, childcare. There was a very uncomfortable conversation that got started in the 60s and 70s. I know I was party to some of those conversations. And it was very tense and not a happy thing. And the food industry, who had been trying to insinuate itself into our households for a very long time, for about 100 years, without too much success, recognized there was an opportunity here. And they stepped forward and they said, we've got you covered. We'll do the cooking. You don't have to do it, and you don't have to argue about it anymore. The symbol of this, for me, is this amazing billboard that Kentucky Fried Chicken erected in the 70s with a giant bucket of fried chicken underneath the two-word slogan, Women's Liberation. And they identified themselves with the aspirations of women, and they also redefined not cooking as a progressive thing to do. They found a tension and then relieved it. This isn't to blame feminism for the collapse of home cooking. It's to suggest that the industry used the rhetoric of feminism to get into the kitchen. There was another way it could have played out, which is we complete this conversation, we renegotiate the division of labor, and cooking becomes shared work in the household, especially if, as the woman we heard from first from North London, if the children are brought in too. And that, I think, is really key. These days, I think we're letting our kids off very easily on chores, certainly, at least in America, where their schoolwork and their success is so important to us that as soon as they tell us they have a lot of homework, they're relieved of any obligations around the house. Oh, yes, you must go, you know, do your homework. But I think we've got to bring them into the kitchen. And if we have men and women and children all with responsibilities in the kitchen, I think we can get the work done.
Why we want this pastry fairly firm. There's a story in Cornwall that a perfect pasty should be so tough that it should be possible to drop it down a tin mine without it breaking. Well, that's a counsel of perfection, which for gastronomic reasons one needn't take too literally.
One replacement of that tradition of handing down cooking expertise from mother to child, usually daughter, has been the television chef, a feature of our screen since the 1930s. But it really took off in the 1950s with Philip Harbin. You just heard him enthusing. Now, TV instruction has got a lot more diverse. There's a cooking program for almost everyone's taste.
Well, there's a huge audience for TV food programs, but how many of those people are really interested in food? Or are they busy defrosting a pizza in a microwave at the same time as watching the antics of the contestants on Come Dine With Me?
The Financial Times food writer Bill Knott.
The 1980s was perhaps the most interesting time because the BBC Education Department, who launched the careers of people like Mado Jaffrey and Ken Hom, I think that was incredibly valuable. They may have started rusting by the 90s, but every kitchen had a wok in the 80s. And that has to, you know, a lot of credit for that has to go to Ken Hom in particular. And in a way, we were learning cooking as a second language. We'd lost it. It hadn't been handed down from generation to generation.
OK, let's get started. I adore food.
That educational tradition of Madder and Ken Hom has been well marinated by cooks such as Nigel Slater and chefs such as Simon Hopkinson, who's just about to tell us how to cook on More 4.
And I want to share my cooking experiences.
The premise of all my cooking is to inspire people to cook, to watch and say, oh, I really want to make that. I really want to have a go at that. I want them not to be nervous. I want them to make it. I want them to cook.
You all have just over 15 minutes to finish your cooking and to plate your dishes, please.
But the big viewing numbers in recent years have involved jeopardy, competition, and being up against the clock.
And, of course, it's now gone full circle. One recent cookery programme, which will be nameless. The prize was, if you can call it that, was to have your prize-winning creation turned into a ready meal for a supermarket. I mean, is that how little we really think of our national food?
Michael Pollan says what we're describing here is the cooking paradox. We watch, read, talk about food more than ever before. But do we cook?
This is odd. This is paradoxical. And it was one of the things that launched me on this project of writing Cooked, is that I was trying to understand why, if we were so ready to get rid of cooking in our lives, would we carve out an hour a day or more to watch other people do this activity, which we could do ourselves? And I'm not sure I know the answer, but part of it is that many of us don't feel we're capable. We're daunted in part by these television cooking shows. Some of them do inspire you, but the primetime entertainment-based cooking shows make it look incredibly difficult. You know, there are knives flying and fountains of flame and a time clock counting down the minutes like the end of a football game. It looks like work best left to professionals. How could you possibly do this? So why do we like to watch it? Because there's a lot of other things in our lives we've outsourced that we don't watch TV shows about. You know, changing the oil in your car. We don't watch TV about that. Cooking's different. Cooking goes deep, partly for the reasons that Wrangham discusses, that it is essential to our identity as a species, but also because we do, most of us, have these amazingly powerful and warm memories of being cooked for as children, of standing in the kitchen, you know, maybe on a stool, watching our mother scramble eggs or one of these other amazing alchemies that happen in the kitchen every day, and the smells and the receipt of this gift. I think we miss it. I really do. Even as we're not doing it, I think we're nostalgic for it.
Michael, in the UK this week, it's been reported by Oxfam that 500,000 people are now relying on food handouts, tins and packets from food banks. At a talk you gave at the RSA in London, one criticism of the book was predicted by Professor of Food Policy Tim Lang, and here it is.
The criticism is this is a fantasy world. This is a fantasy world of anti-progress. It's a fantasy world where busy, urbanized, deracinated people can somehow become artisanal experts. That's the nasty criticism, that this is inappropriate, let me lay it on,
sure,
romantic, elite, telling the masses to cook when actually they're voting with their feet through market economics.
My answer? Well, you know, there are worse things being accused of than being idealistic.
yeah, good answer.
But that's not my whole answer.
No, I hope not.
So, Michael, what is your whole answer to that?
Well, the idea that the progressive future is to do exactly what the marketplace wants us to do at all times. They have strong interest in our not cooking. And so they depict not cooking as very progressive and very modern. And that's all well and good. And if people want to do that, that's fine. What I'm pointing out is that there's a very high cost to it. In terms of our health, in terms of the well-being of our families, because with cooking goes the family meal. You know, my goal is not to tell anyone what they should do because it's good for them. My goal in this book is to tell a story that's gotten lost, which is that what you might have been encouraged to think of as impossible drudgery is actually magic and pleasurable alchemy, and that it's all in how you look at it. And to say that it is elite to cook, well, you know, cooking's very economical, actually. Most of the great cuisines of the world are peasant cuisines developed by people who didn't have a lot of money, who had the gnarliest cuts of meat and the leftovers from the, you know, the great animals. And they figured out beautiful ways to make nutritious food. So the idea that it is elite to cook and populist to eat corporate crap, I just don't accept it.
Finally, on taste, the moment of eating, you left it till the end of the book.
You know, I had a very interesting experience. I mean, this book is about my apprenticeship and learning all these different crafts. And I wanted to learn how to make kimchi for my fermentation section. So I went to South Korea. And I studied only briefly. I mean, I had a workshop with this woman who makes kimchi, and she immediately told me, you know, she said, there are 275 different kimchis in Korea. I'm going to teach you the one I learned from my mother, I mean, the chain that was being passed down. And it was a very painstaking way to make kimchi. You basically brined the Napa cabbage overnight so it got kind of floppy, and you got a lot of the water out of it. And then you made a spice paste, red clay of red peppers and garlic and ginger. And then you massaged that paste into every leaf and between every leaf. And then you folded the head of cabbage just so, and you put it in the bottom of an urn, and then it would get buried outside. And while we were talking, she started talking to me about, she said that Koreans distinguish between something called tongue taste and hand taste. These were very odd terms, and I thought maybe the translator was screwing up. But as she kept talking, I began to understand what she meant. Tongue taste is a chemical transaction that it's the dance of molecules on your tongue, and it can be, and she said it can be simulated. Anybody can do tongue taste. McDonald's does tongue taste very well. But hand taste is something much more elusive, something much deeper, and that is the taste of food that has been made with care, with craft, with conviction, with love. And that's something I think we all recognize. We've had that dish. It's something perhaps our parents made for us. It's something we had in a wonderful restaurant where that food has so much human caring in it, so much attention, that it's very, very special.
Your critics would say, get real, Michael. You know, 9 billion people coming up. Love.
Yeah, love. Food has always been about love, and it always will be, whether there's a little bit of it or a lot of it. So, you know, is that unrealistic? I stand convicted.
There's the beep. Turn it off. Other button. That's right. Here, both gloves.
Back to the family that cooks, Donna, Reuben and Bertie. The mini meatloaf is out of the oven.
What do you think, buddy? You're dribbling.
Yeah, I think it tastes really, really good. And how could a bit of meat and stuff turn into this?
If there's one thing I take from that conversation with Michael Pollan, it's the reminder that cooking really is a miracle of transformation.
Sheila Dillon ending this week's